We shall learn from some degree of specificity as a means of providing adequate notice. And that's what the dates are in the specification for, to put an employee on notice as to what exactly, what time frame-ish that they are charged with committing this particular offense.
There's also a little jeopardy problem, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I mean, we have to ensure that the government doesn't charge the defendant for the same action twice. And the way to do that is by we put some details in the charge.
Yes, Your Honor, we put the details in the charge as the first step to provide notice to the accused. But a double jeopardy defense can be established using the entire record of the trial. So in this case, if the government were to attempt to take the accused to trial again, you could successfully establish a double jeopardy defense by pointing to the facts in the record, which show that the charge at issue here is the one where the child victim says that the child raped her for the first time after she turned 12 in January 2015, but before her brother was born in September 2015. Sometime in the summer, when the mother was bitten with her shorts and while her mother was 7 months pregnant. Those facts are very specific. She also said it happened in the garage on the time and that it happened with the children's nutrition. So if the government were to attempt to take these facts to trial again, the ability to point to those facts and say, I have already been trying for this offense, and the government cannot try me again. And that double jeopardy claim will be successful. So although the dates do matter to a certain degree in that they put on notice, and they narrow the time frame from just the entire time that she's under 16 to the 2015 time frame, the dates alone are not the only thing that protects the ability from a double jeopardy.
So maybe the word surplus is just a bit understated. They, as you just said, they perform important functions, constitutionally required functions. I mean, notice is a fundamental part of the process.
Yes, sir. And perhaps you're right that words are clustered in a way that, to the extent we're saying it doesn't matter at all, that is of course not our position. We're never saying that the dates never matter. There are certain offenses where the charge time frame may actually really matter. For example, in cases charging absence without leave. In Article 86, which criminalizes that offense, makes the actual time of the offense a material element because it requires the government to prove that the accused was not at his place of duty at the time prescribed. But that's because the statute makes the time element.
Article 86, which criminalizes that offense, makes the actual time of the offense a material element because it requires the government to prove that an accused was not at his place of duty at the time prescribed. But that's because the statute makes the time an element, whereas Article 120B in this case, although it makes the child victim's age range a requirement, it doesn't make the precise date of the offense a material requirement. And that's why, that's, I guess, our point when it comes to calling the dates surplusage, and that part of the allegation doesn't have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, such that failure to prove it exactly as alleged should result in set aside.
Counsel, may I ask a question? Is it irrelevant that the government recognized that this was a problem but didn't ask for an instruction regarding findings by substitution or exceptions, and also didn't seek to amend the charge sheet? Does it make any difference that the government saw that this was an issue at trial and said, well, sometimes that happens, but then didn't ask for an instruction?
Your Honor, I think the fact that the government didn't ask for the instruction potentially reflected that they thought it was, because it was close enough to the potentially they thought it was close enough to the charge time frame to fall within on or about, and they argued that in the case of a child, it's not always clear, but I think the point was that she alleged something very specific in 2015. Would we be here had they asked for exceptions and substitutions? Potentially not. However, the fact that they didn't, I think, isn't fatal to our cause because, again, it's not an element of the offense, and so the fact that what really matters is the government proved the age range element, that the child was over the age of 12 but under the age of 16, and they proved whether they had proved the charge time frame or the time frame that actually came out in the evidence, both of those alleged that she was 12 at the age of the offense. So she was 12 years old no matter what, and the difference of being 12 and a half when she was raped versus 12 years and maybe 10 or 11 months, which is what the charge time frame alleged, that's either way, the legal significance of those dates is the same because she was 12 years old.
So
go ahead. May I ask this other question? Suppose we agree with you and we say that English is distinguishable because English is talking about language that narrows the scope of an element, and this wasn't an element, and we reverse the Air Force Court. When we remand the Air Force, when we remand the case, what do we instruct? What does the government want us to instruct the Air Force Court to do?
Your Honor, we'd like for this court to instruct the Air Force Court that when the charge time frame is not a material element of the offense, any discrepancies between the charge dates and the approved dates should be analyzed as variants. So in this case, the Air Force Court treated it like an element of the offense and set it aside based on factual sufficiency. And so what we'd like for this court to clarify for the courts is that that's not what they should be doing when time is not actually an element of the offense, as Article 120B in this case does not make the precise date or season of her crime.
Counsel, as you just mentioned, the CCA resolved this on factual sufficiency, and we don't really do factual sufficiency, at least under the old school, we don't. And so they have to have mistaken the law for us to reverse. So what was their misunderstanding of the law in this case?
Your Honor, we think the Air Force Court was misreading Parker because that's the decision that they cite in justifying the charge time frame like an element of the offense. They believe that Parker essentially requires that we treat the charge time frame of a sexual assault like an element. But we think that's wrong because Parker is not about the charge time frame, but about the requirement to introduce that it's about the requirement that convictions be based on evidence that's properly introduced as substantive proof of the charged offense.
So I'm not sure that's a fair characterization of CCA's opinion. So they look at the decision and they say, we see a discrepancy. Well, they're doing their factual sufficiency review, right, which they have every right to do. And they say, we see a discrepancy between the evidence and the charge sheet. And they'd say, well, normally this would be solved by an exception or a substitution. But here the government didn't ask for that, and the fact finder didn't do it. So therefore, there's no exception or substitution for us to review, because if there had been, then we would launch into variance review, and we'd say, well, was this exception and substitution valid because it was, you know, or was it not valid? They said, but there's nothing for us to do. And this seems to follow exactly what this court did in Lubaski, where we said, the court said, well, normally there would be an exception or a substitution, but now the government's saying we can do it and we don't have that authority. The appellate courts can't do that, so we have to review the conviction as charged and as drafted, and they want us to make an exception. We can't do it, so it's game over. So looking at Lubaski, how is the CCA wrong? Because there was no exception or substitution. The conviction was found exactly as drafted. They looked at it and they said, it doesn't look like on or about to us. So if it's not on or about, then there has to be an exception or a substitution. Here there was none, end of analysis. So when they did all that, what part of that did they get wrong?
Your Honor, I think the CCA's position is wrong because it's premised on the idea that variance can only exist if there are exceptions and substitutions. But that's not the case. Variance exists if there's a difference between the charge sheet and what comes out on the record. As soon as there's a discrepancy, that is variance. Exceptions and substitutions are a way for the fact finder at the trial level to address that. But just because they don't, which, you know, to Your Honor's point, they didn't in this case, just because they don't doesn't mean that the variance disappears on appeal. So it's still there. That difference between the charge sheet and the record is still there when the record of trial reaches the appellate courts.
Why are they not entitled to say there's a variance, it's not on or about the dates charged, therefore it's not factually sufficient? Why are they mandated to perform their own exception and substitution and then review whether that's permissible? Like, where does that mandate? I couldn't find any case where, like, certainly appellate courts overturn convictions because we see a variance and we think the variance was too much, and we overturn it. We do that, right, as you cited cases like that in your brief. But I don't see where there's this mandate on the CCA to say, We look at the facts. We look at the evidence. We look at the charge. We don't find it factually sufficient. It wasn't on or about the dates charged. Therefore, A, where would they get the authority to save the conviction by exceptions to substitutions? And then I guess they would perform the variance analysis to see whether that variance was allowable. But, like, where does that mandate come from, you know, from any case to say, like, no, you have to do this. You don't get to stop after deciding it's not on or about the dates charged.
Your Honor, I think it's a product of a lot of different cases. It's a product of the CCA's duty to actually conduct factual sufficiency and what that review is supposed to be. And that review is supposed to be, when they do factual sufficiency, they're supposed to make an independent determination about whether there is proof of every required element beyond a reasonable doubt. But required elements is the key phrase here. When they're looking at convictions for factual sufficiency, they should be looking at the elements. And elements come from the statute, which come from Congress. And when Congress has said that these four elements are the elements of a child rape, and they haven't made the precise date of the rape a material element, then the courts shouldn't treat it like it won. And from that point, that's when we're looking at whether or not if the dates have provided notice, as they should, which is their function in their charge, then we look at whether or not at that point, that's when the courts are looking. If this is not a material element of the offense, then, and there is still a difference, that is variant, and so we should look at it like one. Has it affected?
Why? Why? I mean, you say should. So why? But why do they have to? Why do they have to? And it's a question to me whether they even the authority. Lebowski certainly suggests they don't have the authority. They're not the fact finder in this case, right? And so, like, if we're saying it wasn't, if the evidence didn't match the charge, why should they bail the government out? Like, where does this mandate? Or is it within their discretion to do it or not do it?
Well, no, I think it's because the justice system, although I think it's important to remember that it's not simply about putting the government through its paces. It is also about justice and accountability. And this court's predecessor has previously said that we shouldn't be focusing on words at the expense of justice. And so that sort of, although that's not a clear mandate to, yes, you must do variance if there's a difference between the specs, I think that larger concept should guide the courts in this area, where if there's something in the allegation, in the specification, that hasn't been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's not actually one of the things that requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt, then that's why, because we shouldn't be focusing on words at the expense of justice, that's why courts should conduct a variance review. And the fact that they're conducting variance review doesn't mean they're necessarily bailing the government out, because we also...
I mean, the government recognized the mistake here. The government had every tool in its toolbox to fix it at various points. We have said in Morton that it is the government's responsibility to determine what offense to bring against the accused, aware of the evidence in its possession. The government is presumably cognizant of which offenses are supported by the evidence and which are not. So why are, again, the burden is on the government. They have all the power. They have all the tools. They get to write the charge sheet, right? So why then, when they screw up, they forget or they don't ask, and then it gets to the CCA. Again, I don't understand, where is this obligation on the CCA? Like, if we were up here and the CCA had chosen to have done this and the appellant was mad about it, we'd be having a different discussion. But here, the CCA said, look, we don't have any authority to do exceptions and substitutions. It's not on or about the date charged, not legally sufficient, right? Not factually sufficient. So where, again, what do we point to? Or what case or what line, what do we say, like, hey, CCA, you got this wrong? Or do we have to make new law, right? Is that what the government's asking? Do we need to say, look, dates are different. When they're not part of the elements of the offense, they're different. You have an obligation to preserve this conviction in respect for the jury or whatever we want to come up with. Is that what the government wants us to hold?
Your Honor, I see my time is about to expire.
Please proceed.
Your Honor, what we point to is what the Supreme Court has said. The Supreme Court has said that not just the Supreme Court, but this Court as well and its predecessor said generally time is not of the essence. And in Ledbetter versus United States, the Supreme Court said that unless a particular day is made material by the statute, it doesn't require it doesn't have to be proved exactly as alleged. And so we're not asking this court to make new law. We're asking this court to clarify for the CCAs what the law already says, which is that the date, unless it's made material by a statute, doesn't require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And when it's not one of the elements, any difference should be analyzed as variance.
Is that, I mean, but is that consistent? Like, we've said a variance between pleadings and proof exists when evidence at trial establishes the commission of a criminal offense by the accused, but the proof does not conform strictly with the offense alleged in the charge. So, is that consistent? Like, you're citing Ledbetter, right, which is from 2 centuries ago, which is fine. It's a fundamental case. But, like, we've also said many times that the government is in charge of the charge sheet, and then they have to prove what they, you know, what they've charged.
Your Honor, you're absolutely right. We are in charge of the charge sheet, and when the accused relies to our control of the charge sheet to his or her detriment, then the courts award relief. And I think English is a perfect example of that. But in this case, that's not this case, because not once, either at trial or at the appellate level, has appellee alleged that he was misled in some way, that he couldn't put on a defense because he didn't know that the states were going to be in the summer instead of the fall. And the fact that there is a difference between the charge sheet and the transcript or the record, that, Your Honor, that is variance to your point, and this isn't Lubaski, because in Lubaski, the government was actually asking the courts to accept and substitute the names of victims in larceny specifications, which is different. Changing out the victim changes the accused offense entirely, but this case, it's clear from the record and the fact that trial defense counsel never argued any type of alibi, never argued in his closing that the government had failed to prove the charge time frame. They just wanted to portray the child victim as a liar. That was their entire defense. And the fact that it happened in the summer versus the fall was not the thing that was going to save appellee in this case.
Any further questions?
No, Chief. The question I had, and it's actually been in this dialogue, but that at its root, you're drawing a distinction between the failure of proof versus the failure in pleadings. Correct? That's your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Lee. Major Johnson.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Frederick Johnson, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, I represent the appellee in this case, Staff Sergeant Joshua Patterson. As the Air Force Court correctly found, the government must prove the facts it chooses to allege. The Air Force Court properly applied this principle and concluded that the evidence was insufficient to prove the time frame alleged in the specification, which the panel found Staff Sergeant Patterson guilty of as drafted. The Air Force Court therefore set aside those findings, and this court should affirm this proper exercise of factual sufficiency review authority. It's important to note that there was no difference in this case between the facts in the specification and the findings. The government points to the difference between the specification and the evidence and says that because there's a difference, there's inherently variance, which requires a variance analysis. But the government is overlooking the importance of the findings in this argument. When the court found Staff Sergeant Patterson guilty as drafted, it was saying, we find him guilty based on these facts. And it's that finding that the Air Force Court was reviewing when it conducted its statutory factual sufficiency review. That is an awesome power, as this court has noted in the past, but it is still a review of those findings. And when the evidence doesn't match the findings, that's when the Air Force Court, or any court of criminal appeals, has the ability to set aside the findings for factual insufficiency, as it did here.
Major Johnson, is there a forfeiture issue floating around here in light of the fact that this was not raised at trial?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing to be forfeited when it comes to factual sufficiency. That's an authority that the courts have de novo as their authority under Article 66. And to whatever extent this wasn't raised at trial, it's because it didn't come up. Had the fact finder made findings by exceptions and substitutions, had there been a variance between the pleading and the findings, then there would have been something to object to at trial, something to address at that level. Indeed, it seems appropriate that then there would have been exactly the analysis that the government is now asking for on appeal. Safsar and Patterson didn't concede that any of these facts proved his guilt. He contested the charges. He litigated this case. And when the fact finder returned findings of guilty anyway, it was simply the normal course of appellate review for him to then go to the Air Force Court and say, for these reasons, the evidence is insufficient to prove the charge and to support the findings. Therefore, it should be set aside. There's no forfeiture issue in that normal course of appellate review.
Of course, here with the charge sheet, it doesn't say between X date and Y date. It says on or about X date to on or about Y date. In the factual sufficiency context, is a CCA engaging in its own unstated variance analysis, or is it the position you're taking that there is no variance analysis that needs to be done here?
It's the latter, Your Honor. There is no variance analysis to be done here. The CCA is just looking at whether the evidence from the trial supports the findings of the court-martial and making its own de novo determination about whether that support is enough to convince that court beyond a reasonable doubt.
So would there be no distinction then, in your view, between a charge sheet that says between X date and Y date as compared to a charge sheet that says on or about? Clearly, if it had happened 11:59 on one date as compared to 12:01 another date, would a CCA, in the course of factual sufficiency review, just say you didn't meet what the charge sheet says? There's no unstated variance analysis that would be going through their minds?
No unstated variance analysis, Your Honor, but the CCA in that case would be very unlikely to overturn it because of that on or about language. The on or about language.
But then, if that's the case, then why isn't there a variance analysis? If you're saying if it's 2 minutes before, 1 minute before midnight as compared to 1 minute after, with the on or about language, why isn't there the sense of, okay, when does on or about end? Is it 1 minute out, 1 day out, 1 week out, 1 month out?
Your Honor, that's not a variance analysis, because when the court looks at whether the on or about language encompasses the time frame proved in the evidence, what it's really looking at is, did the government prove what it charged? If the evidence falls within that on or about language, then the government has proved what it charged, so long as it charged on or about. There's no need to consider whether there was prejudice or whether double jeopardy affects anything, which is what the variance analysis that the government is asking for calls for. And that's really what this court did in United States versus Hunt, the case that the government relies on so heavily. It looked at the appellant's request for a variance and said, well, there's no variance here because it's only 3 weeks outside of the charged time frame, and that's within the on or about language.
So then when a CCA is looking at this issue, in any case, in a factual sufficiency review, we don't really have the authority to double-guess them on how they've decided the on or about determination.
That's correct, Your Honor. This Court doesn't have the authority, at least under the old standard, which is the one that applies here, to second-guess the determinations of fact that are made by the CCA. This Court can only review factual sufficiency determinations for the application of correct legal principles. And those legal principles here are the ones espoused by the Court in United States versus Parker, United States versus English.
Can we speak about English?
Yes, Your Honor.
The government in its reply brief says that English is distinguishable because the language at issue there narrowed the scope of an element of the offense. But the language at issue here, the time frame, isn't directly concerned with any of the elements. What is your response to the government's attempt to distinguish English?
Two things, Your Honor. First, the charging scheme here does narrow the scope of the offense by narrowing it from any time or any time within the 4 years that the victim was a certain age. It does narrow it to a certain time frame. So that narrowing that English talks about is still there. And to the extent that the government says, well, that doesn't apply to an element, it just applies to, in their words, surplusage, that really makes their test for what is an element or not unworkable. As the government acknowledged, both in its brief and during oral argument, there is a scenario in which this very charge could depend on dates because the age of the victim matters. The government tries to distinguish that from this case and say because the evidence was still within that 4-year range, it doesn't matter here. But if that's the case, then whether an element must be proven actually depends on the evidence that comes out at trial. Neither the government nor the defense nor the court would know until the evidence comes out whether it's a quote-unquote essential element that has to be proven. If the victim had testified to a date frame or to a time frame that takes it outside of that window where the victim's age is as charged, now suddenly the date does become an essential element by the government's definition. We can't have this moving target approach to what the government has to prove.
Isn't that kind of what we decided, rightly or wrongly, in Brown, though, that, you know, if it doesn't matter in this particular case, it doesn't matter?
The important thing, Your Honor, is that the government has to be able – the government has to meet its burden, and the defense has to be able to know what that burden is. And it matters because the victim's age is inherently linked to the date of the offense. And to simply say, well, the age is proven even though the date didn't match, it essentially gives the government a do-over on its failure of proof on that element.
Can I ask one other question, which is that I think the year was 2015, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was just a discrepancy between whether it was in the fall or summer or early or late spring of 2015. So they did prove 2015. Wasn't that enough?
No, Your Honor. Not where the government has chosen to narrow it beyond 2015.
But the specific month wouldn't be relevant for proving the age of this. Wasn't necessary in this case to prove the age of the victim, was it?
The victim, I don't remember exactly when the birthday was. It could have been sometime within that same year. Most of the year likely would have at least shown the age. But when the government chose to narrow it, it created additional issues that beyond just that. That issue gets to how we determine what the elements are, but there are other issues about the defense's ability to address the facts alleged in the specification. As the evidence shows, as the government's own evidence shows, Sergeant Patterson was actually deployed OCONUS for all but 5 days of this charge time frame. And on top of that, the victim's own testimony put it well before the charge time frame. But because the government chose to allege that, Sergeant Patterson faced difficulty in addressing the actual allegation that came out at trial because he didn't know about that beforehand because the government hadn't put him on notice. The government controls the charge sheet, and when it chooses to allege certain facts, it needs to prove those. If it becomes apparent that it's going to be unable to do so, or even that the evidence that's come out doesn't match, it has the tools to address that. As this Court clearly recognized in United States v. Parker, the government can always withdraw and dismiss the charges and specifications and re-prefer new charges that match the evidence that they have. The government's argument about a failure of pleading is essentially just admitting that it failed to prove what it pled. A failure of pleading is ultimately a failure of the government to meet its burden. And as this Court noted in questioning the government, it could have sought findings by exceptions and substitutions. And if the fact finder had seen fit to use those, it would have then been ripe for the very variance analysis that the government now asks for. But because it didn't, the Air Force Court was correct in reviewing the findings and whether the evidence supported them.
Counsel, I want to follow up on something the Chief asked you. He was asking if there's anything this Court could do to review the on or about determination by the CCA, that it wasn't on or about the date specified. And in the CCA's decision, they cited us, and they said CAF has held that on or about connotes a range of days to weeks, and they cite a bunch of cases. What if they had not said that? What if they had said, in our view, on or about means up to a year? Would that be a misunderstanding of the law?
That would be a misunderstanding of this Court's holding in Simmons, Your Honor. And so this Court could review that for an application of correct legal principles. But the Air Force Court, as you note, Your Honor, in citing United States versus Simmons and in using this Court's own words of reasonably near and within a range of days to weeks, appropriately applied the law. That's an application of the correct legal principle that this Court has articulated in Simmons based on a series of cases before that where acceptable ranges were all within a few days or a few weeks, certainly before what would generally be referred to as months or years. And that's what we have in this case, where the Air Force Court found that the range was at least 3 months and possibly more. As the Court noted, that possibility doesn't help the government because it makes the proof beyond a reasonable doubt even less likely. If there's a mere possibility that it could have been different from those 3 months, that's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so whatever the actual date is, the Air Force Court correctly applied this Court's precedent to find that it's outside that on or about range, and that's an application of legal principles that this Court should affirm because it's based directly on United States versus Simmons.
Now, the government argues that once you have this discrepancy between the charge and the proof, that the CCA should have and erred by failing to launch into a variance analysis. Do you have a response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Not only did the court not err by failing to do that, the court should not have done that. It would be reversible error if it had, based on this Court's holding in United States versus Lebaski and then applied in United States versus English. The Court in Lebaski clearly noted that because of that discrepancy, it would review for variance, it would test for prejudice, if there had been findings by exceptions and substitutions, if there had been a variance in the findings. But because there wasn't, this Court explicitly declined to engage in that analysis. And it continued that holding in United States versus English, where the Court of Criminal Appeals had actually engaged in its own exceptions and substitutions. And this Court reversed it, saying that that is not an appropriate exercise of appellate authority. The government tries to say that that's not what would be happening here, that it would just be affirming the conviction despite the difference in the dates. But essentially, that is what the CCA would be doing, even if it didn't say so. It would be substituting its own determination of the dates for the trial court's determination of the dates, and then affirming a conviction based on those facts that are different from the facts found by the trial court. That's something that this Court cannot allow the Service Courts of Criminal Appeals to do in exercising their factual sufficiency review authority, because it would create a situation where defendants have to start anticipating what different facts a CCA might use on appeal in order to try and address those at trial. The much simpler and clearer rule is the one that this Court has already articulated through its cases. The government must prove what it alleges, and when it fails to do so, and there are no findings by exceptions and substitutions, the CCA reviews those findings for factual sufficiency. And if the evidence fails to prove them, then it is an insufficient finding. It's also important to note why the dates are alleged in specifications. The government acknowledged during its argument that that's done regularly, that it always includes dates. And that's largely because the MCM requires it. Every model specification has a place for dates to be inserted. And in addition to that, Rule for Court-Martial 307C3 states that a specification should include essential facts constituting the offense charged. The government says nothing about how those essential facts are different from essential elements that it says don't need to be proven. And the government's view of what is and is not essential elements really goes against that requirement from the manual to allege essential facts. And the government also brushes over another problem with its view of what makes an essential element. If dates are not essential because they're not included in the statutory scheme, then that would apply to other things that aren't included there, such as the identity of the victim. The statute doesn't say you must identify a victim. It just says a person. If the government's view is correct, then a conviction could be upheld even if the evidence proved a different victim than what the court-martial found. And that simply can't be the case. When the government alleges these specific facts, it needs to prove them beyond a reasonable doubt. And if it fails to do so, if its evidence doesn't match the findings, that is grounds for reversal. The government's evidence in this case was simply not good enough, especially for government work, and especially to meet the high burden to which we hold the prosecution in our system. For that reason, this Court should affirm the Air Force Court's exercise of its factual sufficiency review and should answer the granted question in this case in the negative.
Further questions? Thank you, Major Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Lee.
Your Honor, you asked Appellant's counsel, does honor about mean the CCA is engaging in an unstated variance analysis? The answer, Your Honor, is absolutely yes. And if the CCA concludes that honor about doesn't apply, at that point it has found a material variance. But material variance alone doesn't justify set-aside. In the federal courts, even in our system, when there is material variance, there has to be a prejudice analysis. And that is what did not happen here. The CCA found that it was not honor about the dates alleged. Well, then its next step should have been to ask whether or not appellee was prejudiced, or whether or not appellant was prejudiced in any way. My apologies, I'm appellant. Whether or not the accused was prejudiced in any way by this difference between the dates charged versus the dates proved. Was he misled in that he couldn't put on a defense? Was he deprived of the opportunity to present a defense? Did it put him at risk of another prosecution? And the answer to all of those questions is no. The facts are very specific, that this was the first time appellee raped her, that it happened when she was 12, and that it happened before her brother was born.
And that approach would have been entirely inconsistent with what this Court said to do in Lebowski, but that would be okay in the government's view in this case because of the different nature of the fact we have a date instead of a specific way the offense was committed.
Yes, Your Honor. And Lebowski is distinguishable because in that case on appeal, the government was asking the court to accept and substitute the names of the victims of a larceny offense, which naturally, you know, the accused in that case hadn't had an opportunity to defend against a charge that he stole from a merchant instead of a person. And that's why it's different, because that goes to an elemental fact. But in this case, the date range that whether it's fall 2015 or summer 2015, didn't actually change anything about what the government had to prove in terms of the elements. They still had to prove that accused committed a sexual act on a child who was over the age of 12 but under the age of 16.
Well, it didn't change the facts in the other case either, right? I mean, the government had elected to put information into the charge in the specific way that the act was committed that they were under no obligation to do. Right? The elements didn't require that. So what's the difference? The government elects to put extra information in the charge sheet, then typically this Court has said, well, you're in charge of the charge sheet. Once you've alleged it, you have to prove it. I don't really understand the difference. I mean, there the government put information that they didn't need in, but because it was related to a specific element, that's what makes a difference? Because it wasn't statutory. They didn't say how the act was committed. Congress has never required that. The president doesn't require it. The government elected to do it. And then, so why is that a part of a critical element, but like dates aren't?
We are to answer your question and to address something that a police counsel said. Sure, the statute doesn't say you must put the victim's name in the specification, but the statute requires proof that the accused committed a sexual act on a child victim. And when we allege the name of the victim or specifics about larceny, such as who is being stolen from, that is to put the accused on notice. And when we look at those things, we should ask, has it served its purpose? Was the accused sufficiently on notice of what is actually alleged, in what he's alleged to have committed? In this case, he was. In Lubaski, where they're switching out victim names on appeal, he could not possibly have been on notice that he was going to be convicted of larceny for stealing from a merchant instead of the person that was alleged at trial. And that's the difference, Your Honor.
I was wondering if you could please address the argument that in a case such as this, where the date isn't of particular relevance to the elements and so forth, that in a factual sufficiency context, that on or about could be viewed essentially from a lay person's view of it. You say to someone who is not a lawyer, the person on the sidewalk, is Y date on or about X date as compared to the idea that it is required to do a variance analysis where even though it's in the factual sufficiency context, the CCA needed to go through and determine whether there was variance, whether it was material, whether it affected it, and so forth, as you're arguing. What about that argument? In the terms of factual sufficiency, is just CCA's authority to say, on or about, in our view, was not on or about. No variance analysis necessary.
Your Honor, I think to answer your question, it's important to go back to what factual sufficiency review requires of the CCAs. And it's that they find that everything is correct in law and fact. And when it comes to the actual factual sufficiency review, they're supposed to make an independent determination about whether there are all the required elements of the offense. And our court, our Supreme Court in McMillan has said that when it comes to determining what facts need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, Congress's definition of the elements is dispositive because Congress is the one entrusted by the Constitution to define crimes and their offenses. And, Your Honor, I see my time has run out.
Please proceed.
And so that's just as the federal courts look to the statute as their very first stop, so too should the military courts. And when the statute sets out three or four elements, those are the things that need to exist with proof beyond a reasonable doubt for purposes of factual sufficiency. And when they found those elements, to the extent they find another discrepancy, that's the point at which they should be considering whether or not there was prejudice to the accused. And this will, of course, be a case-by-case determination because the dates in some offenses may actually be material. In other offenses like this case, the specific date of the offense is not material.
Are there questions?
I have one question based upon the Chief's question and based upon your response. Does your view that, as characterized by the Chief Judge, that the CCA should have done a variance analysis if they thought there was a difference between what was proved and what was pleaded? And you reference kind of the federal courts and how they do it. I assume you're talking about federal appellate courts. But doesn't the military system differ so vastly in this respect from the federal civilian courts because of this awesome and unique power that the CCAs have under their duties to conduct a factual sufficiency review? And it's still not clear to me in your answer to the Chief Judge why the CCA can't determine as a matter of fact that the on or about language has not been proven to their satisfaction, acting as the 13th juror, so to speak. So I hate to go over what you just talked with him, but I'm still, in my mind, it's not settled by your question, by your response to his question.
So, Your Honor, to take your question sort of piece by piece, yes, the federal system is different in that they don't have factual sufficiency review. That's true, but they engage in the equivalent of legal sufficiency, where they also have to look at whether or not there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt of all the elements of the offense. And so in that regard, both systems are looking for the required elements, and those required elements come from the statute. As to why the CCA can't determine in fact that it didn't meet the on or about, I think the CCA can do that. And when they do that, they've found a material variance in fact.
But is it proper to call it a material variance if they simply say we're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt? Or is there a distinction? Maybe there's no difference in your position, but that's what I'm asking.
Your Honor, they may say that they are not, it's true, if they find that it's not on or about, they're not convinced that it's on or about the alleged date range. However, they don't have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt because it's not an element of the offense. And so even if they're not convinced, they have to analyze whether or not that the fact that that date wasn't proved exactly as alleged prejudiced the appellee in some way that this conviction should be set aside. And in a case where they have otherwise found proof beyond a reasonable doubt of all the statutory elements, then appellee shouldn't walk free for raping his 12-year-old stepdaughter simply because she says it happened in the summer and the charge sheet says he did it in the fall.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Lee. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All right. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.